Reading the prophets is not always easy. And I think most of the time the difficulty in reading the prophets comes because that we know so little about the historical context. Not that we couldn't learn, but when we go as readers to these books, sometimes we don't go with all of the history in mind. And so I would suggest that one of the simplest ways to start getting a historical feel for the prophecies is to read those related portions of the scriptures. And for the Kings, that's oftentimes, but not always, the books of Kings and Chronicles. And that advice is not less true for Isaiah. Isaiah's prophecy has historical context to it. And you get some of the history of that context in the book of Isaiah itself. In fact, there are two major historical sections to that book. And yet, we can get some history outside of the book as well. And so Isaiah's prophecy has a historical context. For instance, if you take a look at Isaiah 1:1, what are we told? We're told that Isaiah's prophetic tour of duty spanned the reigns of four kings: Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And if you were to go back to 2 Chronicles 26, for instance, you'll find that that particular section deals with the reign of Uzziah. And as I was rereading that particular portion of Scripture this past week, because I think it's a good habit for us to go back to those historical sections, especially those historical sections that pertain to each of these kings, and just reread them, as I went back to that particular section this past week, I noticed that having been through Isaiah 1 through 5, I noticed that there are themes or parallel ideas that begin to emerge that are in each book, in 2 Chronicles 26 and in the first five chapters of Isaiah. What's even more significant, I thought, as I thought about this, I thought the biography of Uzziah and the first five chapters of Isaiah have even more companionship, because in chapter 6 of Isaiah we're told that Uzziah dies. He's dead by that time. And so to help you get the feel for the prophecy that helped me this past week, I thought I might introduce our reading today by giving you at least three themes that emerge between these two sections of Scripture, 2 Corinthians, Chronicles 26 and Isaiah 1 through 5. So let me give those three themes to you now. First, Isaiah tells us at least twice that children will rule in Judah. Now, what's interesting is this. If Ahaz meant that rulers would be childlike, that's certainly a possibility. But it doesn't change the fact that Uzziah was only 16 years old when he took the throne. In fact, if you read this portion of prophecy, knowing that your king came to power when he was a mere 16 years old, I don't think that you could help but make the connection. The interpretation is certainly left open, but the connection is obvious. That's the first parallel. And second, running right through Isaiah chapter 2 and 3 is the subject of pride. It's there. Even when the word pride isn't used, it's there. But it is there. The word is there. In chapter 2:11 and verse 17, there is a similar refrain. I'll just read one of them. The pride of man will be humbled, and the loftiness of men will be abased, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. Pride was a problem in Judah. Now, strikingly enough, the chronicler tells us that when Uzziah became strong, his heart was so proud that he acted corruptly. You see, pride was descriptive of king and people, and Isaiah does not shrink from telling us this. And then third, is the song itself, the song of the vineyard. Now, the song is in verses 1 through 6. Isaiah brings this song on behalf of the Lord. Now, who can deny that vineyards were an important part of the life of Judah and Jerusalem? They were. They were an important part. It was a dry climate. They grew in that climate. Vineyards were the staple of the workaday life. But when I reread the biography of Uzziah in Chronicles, I noticed something that I hadn't noticed before. And because Dr. Spear had read it a few weeks earlier, I read it in his voice because he emphasized this point. What did he emphasize? This personal note in 2 Chronicles 26:10. Uzziah built towers in the wilderness and hewed many cisterns, for he had much livestock, both in the lowland and in the plain. He also had plowmen and vine dressers in the hill country and the fertile fields. And then there's this personal note in all these lists of accomplishments, for he loved the soil. And I thought to myself, a song about the vineyard would have been near and dear to the heart of a king who loved the soil, who loved the soil. And so that, I think, is those elements, I think, that run parallel to one another are helpful in aiding us to see the connection, the historical context between Isaiah's prophecy. And I think that when we read this song together, knowing the things that I laid out for you, it will be helpful as well. So let me read to you Isaiah chapter 5, the whole chapter. Let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. He dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it, and also hewed out a wine vat in it. And then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So now let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its walls, and it will become trampled ground. I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed; for righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field, until there is no room, so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. In my ears the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones without occupants. For 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine, and an omer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening, that wine may inflame them. Their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. Therefore my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore Sheol has enlarged its throat, opened its mouth without measure, and Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her din of revelry, and the jubilant within her descend into it. So the common man will be humbled, and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud will also be abased. But the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show himself holy in righteousness. Then the lambs will graze as in their pasture, and strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. Woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood, and sin as if with carts or cart ropes, who say, Let him make speed, let him hasten his work, that we may see it. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass, that we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. Therefore, as the tongue of fire consumes stubble and dry grass collapses into the flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. On this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against his people, and he has stretched out his hand against them and struck them down. And the mountains quaked, and their corpses lay like refuse in the middle of the streets. For all this, his anger is not spent, but his hand is still stretched out. He will also lift up a standard to the distant nation, and will whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come with speed swiftly. No one in it is weary or stumbles. None slumbers or sleeps, nor is the belt at his waist undone, nor its sandal strap broken. Its arrows are sharp, and all its bows are bent. The hoofs of its horses seem like flint, and its chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Its roaring is like a lioness, and it roars like young lions. It growls as it seizes the prey and carries it off with no one to deliver it. And it will growl over it in that day like the roaring of the sea. If one looks to the land, behold, there is darkness and distress. Even the light is darkened by its clouds. I told you last time that Isaiah is something of a prophetic anthology. That's not to say that there are not overlapping themes. We should expect that. We should expect overlapping themes in Isaiah's prophecies, in the pieces that he wrote, and we do see that. But we certainly see the anthology-like pieces in the first five chapters of Isaiah's prophecy. For instance, in chapter 1, we appear to be in a courtroom atmosphere. Charges are brought, witnesses are called, and judgments are made. But we're told at the end of that particular chapter that in the end, mercy will triumph. And then there's the second section, chapters 2, 3, and 4. And there we learn that despite the coming judgment on Judah and Jerusalem, there would come a time called the last days when the nations would flow upward toward Jerusalem and lives would be changed and everything would culminate in a glorious end. But this third section is a song. And it's not quite like the previous two sections, although there are some verbal overlaps and some ideas that are found in all three sections. This particular section is the darkest section of all. It's a dark song. It's a dark song. And it's a dark song because if you think about the previous two sections, had some glory and light and mercy and redemption. And if you read this song has darkness and distress and woe. And one wonders how often this song would have been sung in Israel. You know, it's sort of like some of the songs that we have in the Psalter that we probably wouldn't sing very often unless they had that upbeat tune in them. You know, the ones I'm talking about, like 18K, I chased and overtook my enemies. I swept them out like dust on the floor. And you know how the tune goes. I chased and overtook my enemies. And we've put it to an upbeat, almost happy tune. And we sing it. And so how about 137? It's very similar. It's a very troubling psalm, and yet we put it to a tune that we love. I wonder how often this song would have been sung because it's very dark and it's very troubling. But despite the darkness, it has a very important theme to it. For instance, How did Israel get to this point? And it raises the question, is there any hope for Israel? Will mercy be available to such a wicked group of people? And the difficulty is, as I've already said, the song doesn't lighten up. It doesn't give us that grace, that mercy. At least we don't see it readily in the first, even the second reading. So as we come to this text, let's begin just to think through it together. And the thing that I want you to notice, first of all, is the care of the beloved. I want you to notice the care of the beloved. It's in the song. And the song is verses 1 through 6. Now, we're not told the original setting of this particular song. However, Deuteronomy 16:13 says, "You shall celebrate the Feast of Booths 7 days after you have gathered in from your threshing floor and your wine vat, and you shall rejoice in your feast." And so, perhaps Isaiah wrote this song under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit for the Feast of Booths, when they would be celebrating after having their threshing finished and their wine vats full and finished. And so perhaps that's when this song was sung, or an occasion like it. Regardless, we have the song. And Isaiah tells his hearers and his readers that he is going to sing a song for his beloved. But it's not simply for his beloved, as though he were dedicating this song to his beloved. No, he's singing the beloved's song. Now, the song has several parts to it. And the first part of the song simply recounts the work of the farmer in preparing the vineyard. He says that he chose a particular hill that have had evidence of fertility. And then he dug out the ground to remove the rocks. And I want you to just think about the work that a farmer would have put into that. I mean, this is an 11-acre piece of property, and on a riding mower, it feels like forever mowing it, for those of you who've mowed it. Can you imagine taking a shovel and turning over about 6 acres of this land, or maybe even all 10 or 11 acres of it, by hand? And then after you turn over the soil, you take a hoe and you chop up the clumps and you remove the rocks. And what you do with the rocks, as we're told here in the song, is you carry the rocks to the perimeter, because you want to build a fence so that the animals that like the vines so well can't get to them. Now imagine that farmer putting all that work into it. And then and only then was the field ready for planting. Now, Hebrew scholars point out that the word for vines here is not the usual word. It's the word sorek. And it likely means the choicest variety of vines. But any variety of vine is going to take about 2 years to produce grapes. So in the intervening time, the song tells us that the farmer decided that he was going to build a tower right in the middle of the property. He was going to take the leftover stones that were from the perimeter, and he was going to use them, and he was going to build a tower in the middle of all the acreage so that he could stay watchful. But not only that, he tells us that he built a wine vat on the property so that after harvest he could make the wine right there on the spot. And after all this work, he waited, and he expected his vineyard to produce good grapes. And then all of a sudden, this conclusion. But instead of producing good grapes, the vines produced worthless grapes. Now imagine singing this song. Imagine that you're at this festival. You're at this feast and you sing this song. Here's the king. He's in front of you. And you're singing to the king and you're singing to the people. Can you imagine singing this song with that conclusion to a man who loves the soil? Or to people who just harvested their vineyards? They could have empathized with the farmer. They felt for him. And notice what the prophet does. He pulls them into the song, doesn't he? He pulls them almost like Nathan does with David. He pulls him into the story. He says, "And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I've not done for it?" Now, at this point, I want you to pause for a minute. I want you to go to Mark's Gospel, chapter 12. Go to Mark's Gospel, chapter 12. Mark's Gospel, chapter 12. If you're using the Bible in the chair, you'll find that on page 1010. Page 1010. Now, in the opening verse, we find that Jesus tells a parable. He says this: "A man planted a vineyard and put a wall around it, and dug a vat under the wine press and built a tower." Sound familiar? Sounds very familiar. Jesus is clearly rooting his parable in Isaiah chapter 5, but in Mark's gospel, Jesus expands the story. For example, in Jesus' story, there are renters, vine dressers, who are bad renters. They don't pay their rent. Let me put it this way. From the standpoint of the beloved, the owner, this vineyard might as well not exist. Why? Because it produces no fruit. So you can see how the story in Isaiah chapter 5, or the song in Isaiah chapter 5, and the story that Jesus tells on the basis of Isaiah chapter 5 is different, and yet both flow together and both are able to manage the same message. Now, in Jesus' version, he goes on to tell us that the owner of the vineyard sent messengers, the prophets, to call the renters to account. And the careful reader will understand that Isaiah is one of those messengers. Isaiah is bringing the word of God to bear upon the wicked renters. He has been sent by the beloved. Now, what makes this so powerful is this. Have you noticed that Isaiah has slipped into the first person? Go back to Isaiah chapter 5 and look at verse 3. He is no longer speaking about the beloved or even for the beloved. He is now speaking as the beloved. Here the prophet stands at full height in his prophetic office. His words are God's words. He has come on behalf of the beloved, and what he speaks, God has spoken through him. And you begin to realize even more, with all of this providential care and this word to them, what more could be done for them? What more could be done for them? Now, I don't want to dwell on this point right now, but I do want to put this thought in your head. We can learn from this, can't we? Because with all God's providential care over us, we just think about the providential care that we've experienced and God's words spoken into our lives. We could ask ourselves the same question: what more could God do for us that he hasn't done already? Well, let me move on now to the second point and ask, what went wrong? What went wrong? Well, I want to make two points here. And the first thing I want to do is I want to describe the woes in this song. There are five woes altogether, five sins altogether. And then what I want us to do is I want us to draw some conclusions from what went wrong, from these woes. And I think there's a main point with a thread that runs through each of them. And I'll try to put it together as we go, but certainly in the conclusion I'll try to bring it to bear upon you. The first woe begins in verse 8. Now, On first reading, you might mistakenly think that the prophet is condemning wealth. On the second reading, we realize that it's not wealth for wealth's sake that's being condemned. No, the prophet is speaking against greed. But the prophet has something even more specific in mind. Now, I might add at this point, because it'll prove helpful in our reading, that the prophet deals with a particular sin, and then what he does is, he does one of two things. He either shows us what that sin produces, or he shows us what's behind it. And so it's a good thing to keep that in mind as we go through this set of woes. So for example, not only do we see the behavior of greed in this woe that's listed here, we see just how corrosive a sin it is. In other words, one of the things that Isaiah pulls out that greed produces is isolation. In other words, greed isolates a person. It destroys our relationship with God and others. It causes us to be alone with ourselves. And it's that solitude, that isolation that the prophet picks up on in this text. I want you to think about it. He says, when you join house to house and field to field, what happens? Well, there's eventually no room for anyone else left, is there? It's just you. But there's something else that the sinner never seems to be able to understand. Not only does it corrode man's relationship to God and neighbor, but sin also destroys the blessing that the sinner seeks after so fervently. In this case, the land will produce next to nothing. 10 acres of land, the patch of land here, after all the hard work the farmer put in it, will produce about 6.5 gallons. Now, there's a lesson in this, isn't there? A lesson that will help us to see the woes that will follow in their proper light. And the lesson we need to learn is that blessing is not attached to physical things. Blessing comes from our union with God, or as Jesus puts it, and this becomes important, eternal life is knowing God, knowing God. Now, listen for that as we go even further in these woes. And that leads to the second woe beginning in verse 11. The second woe describes the man who pays no attention to God, nor does he even stop to consider God's works. Instead, he's caught up in his own sinful life. And so Isaiah paints us a picture of what must have been and still is a common scene. Isaiah describes a man who gets up in the morning and looks for his alcoholic drink, and then, having found it, pursues the bottle all day long. Now, in the previous text, the woe was not wealth. And so, too, here, the woe is not drink. So what's the sin? The sin is the gluttonous attitude of the man who pursues the drink. The man is self-consumed. His desires have consumed him. And I can't help but think that the prophet is telling us something in this woe that he told us in the last woe. The pursuit of the bottle is a solitary act. It becomes a solitary act, doesn't it? Because the drunkard, you know, it says here that the drunkard drinks with his lyre and his tambourine, and it's a party. But eventually, you don't need the party if you're a drunkard. You just want the bottle. Because the man wants to be alone with his drink. And here is the thing that gets us behind the behavior. Here it is. He has no regard for God, and he does not pay attention to the deeds of the Almighty. His concern is for his appetite, namely getting a bottle to his mouth day and night. His appetite, his appetite, his appetite is never consumed. And here is the interesting thing that Isaiah tells us. Isaiah says to us something very frightening. This is the darkness of the song. He says to us, there is that which has its appetite satisfied. The man who has his mouth open for the bottle is never satisfied. But Sheol, death,
has its mouth open waiting for him. And he will eventually fall into that mouth, and Sheol will be satisfied.
And that brings us to the third woe, beginning in verse 18. Remember, the first woe dealt with the person who longs to grab all the land. He's cultivating solitude toward neighbor. And the second woe deals with the man who has no concern but his desire. And he has no regard for God, and he's creating solitude. And not this. Remember, the last woe was solitude toward neighbor. This woe is solitude toward God. And what do we have here in these first two woes? We have a man who has rejected the first and second great commandments. Now, at this point, in this third woe, it's almost like the sinner woke up. It's almost like he's heard the second woe and he wakes up. He hears Isaiah and he wakes up. Notice what he says. Notice what the sinner says in verse 19. Let him, meaning God, let him make speed. Let him hasten his work that we may see it. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass that we may know it. In other words, Mr. Prophet, maybe God should make himself plain if he wants us to have regard for him, if he wants us to pay attention to him. You see how almost the second woe flows into the third woe. But I've got news for you, Mr. Prophet. Until God makes himself plain to me, I'm all about me. And see, at this point, once again, the prophet gets behind the behavior. And he gets behind the behavior in verse 18. Isaiah says that people are like beasts. And they're pulling, and they're like beasts pulling a cart of falsehood behind them. And they're pulling it with cords. And the longer they pull the falsehood, the stronger, the tighter the knots and the ropes get. In fact, it's really interesting. The cords seem to grow into cart ropes in this verse. The longer you pull your falsehoods around, the more bound you are to them. And that's the danger, you see. You isolate yourself from your neighbor. You isolate yourself from God. And you pull around these falsehoods, and the longer you pull them around, the tighter you're bound to them. And then we come to the fourth woe, beginning in verse 20. And here we see a group bound by their falsehoods. This text says that they call good evil and evil good. And the text tells us why they do it. They do it because they are wise in their own eyes. They're wise in their own eyes. And then finally, there's this fifth woe beginning in verse 22. This woe demonstrates how this progression of sin can turn a society upside down. The wicked become the hero. The wicked are the ones who are justified. And it is just anarchy and chaos. Now, having these sins before us, let me draw some conclusions now. And let me begin with a question. How is a person sanctified? I want you to answer that to yourself. How is a person sanctified? Well, I want you to, if you just take a second, I want you to go to John 17. John 17. Now, this isn't a sermon on sanctification, but I want to make at least a point here that seems to grow out of Isaiah. Isaiah 17 on page 1081, if you're using the Bible in the chair. And I want to read verses 17 through 19. 17:17-19. Jesus says in this prayer, "Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. For their sakes I sanctify myself, that they themselves also may be sanctified in the truth." The believer is sanctified in God's truth. And the Word is truth. And so when the Word is brought to bear upon a person's life, the Spirit of truth, John 14:17, uses that Word to shape us. He sanctifies you. Now, have you noticed a common thread in this passage? These people are self-consumed, full of their own desires. They, what? Lack knowledge because they're bound to falsehoods. Why? Because they're wise in their own eyes. You see the problem? You see the problem here? You see, they've rejected the law of the Lord and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. And on that account, the anger of the Lord has burned against His people. And because of their lack of knowledge and they're heading for exile, and from verses 25 through 30, Isaiah tells us how dreadful it will be. He says to them, okay, all right. You want to be brought, you want God to be brought near to you? You want to see His works? Fine. God is about ready to whistle. And when He does, a distant nation is going to come like a dog running to its master, ready to do His bidding. And in that day, we'll see how wise you are. On that day, only darkness and distress. And you know, this leads us to ask a very serious question. We know how the Lord cared for His people. We know they failed to hear. We know they were exiled for their lack of knowledge. But the question comes in the third point. Is there any hope? Is there any hope in this text? And the answer is yes. Do you see it yet? There is hope in this text. It's in verse 17. Look at it. Then the lambs will graze as in their pasture, and strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. Right in the middle of the song, there's this peaceful picture of lambs grazing in a field. In the midst, now you say, well, wait a minute, aren't they grazing in the midst of ruins? Isn't this ruined Jerusalem, sacked Jerusalem, a Jerusalem that's been carried away by the Assyrians? Yeah. But there's a lot of grass there. And it doesn't mean that they're without a shepherd. In fact, if you fast forward, just flip ahead in Isaiah to chapter 40. Flip ahead, fast forward ahead to chapter 40. And this is a chapter set after the exile, after the destruction that this song talks about, after God has whistled and the Assyrian dog has come to do the master's bidding. And notice in chapter 40, verses 1 and 2, look at what God says. He says, comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak kindly to Jerusalem and call out to her that her warfare has ended, that her iniquity has been removed, that she has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Notice, this is after the exile, after the punishment, and God is telling His messenger to speak kindly to His people. And then look, jump down to verse 11. Like a shepherd, He will tend His flock. In His arms, He will gather the lambs and carry them in His bosom. He will gently lead the nursing ewe lambs. They are not without a shepherd. Let me ask you a question. As we've gone through this very dark and distressing song, have you seen yourself in the woes? Even a little bit. Have you seen yourself in the woes? I want you to know, my friends, the hope extends beyond Israel. The hope extends beyond Israel. And because it does, let me tell you to do one thing this morning. I want you to go to John chapter 10 and read it. Read all of it. And there you'll notice that those who listen for the shepherd's voice, those who are the shepherd's sheep, will hear Him. And so the thing that I want you to do is I want you to listen for His voice in the inscripturated word and in the preached word, and pray that you will be able to hear Him more and more. And then turn from your past sins and fix your eyes upon Jesus, the Good Shepherd, and follow Him.